Again, before I begin with the history, let me first say that I want to acknowledge that if there's any good that I have done, it is only because of the grace of God. And if I dare forget that, I'm sure the Lord will let me fall flat on my face. The only thing I can claim are my faults, where I have failed the Lord. And I have failed Him. I want you to know that. But I also want you to know that when we do fail, that God always takes us back to Him and His heart. He always forgives, and we become better, even better than before. Because a fall sometimes is an occasion of being more humble, depending on God more, being very distrustful of even our talents. One of my Carmelite confreres used to say, we're all too anxious to rattle our talents when we're doing the Lord's work, forgetting that Jesus said, without me you can do nothing. Doesn't matter what talents you have. If you focus only on them, then we're motivated by vanity and our own foolishness, and God is not glorified. So we must never forget that. So to begin, I was born December the 1st, 1917, in the suburbs of Pittsburgh, a place called Lawrenceville. And obviously that was during the war. I believe November the 11th, 1917, there was an armistice. So it was, you might say, after the war. And my parents, both of them, were born in Europe. My father in Czechoslovakia, my mother in Yugoslavia. My mother was Slovenian. They were not wealthy, not even middle class. I would say we were part of the lower middle class. Father worked in a mill for 40 years. My mother did the homemaking, and we had 9 children. I was 7 of number 9, of 9. 3 died young, 2 as babies, boy and a girl. And my oldest brother, Charles, my mother told me that he wanted to be a priest. And God seemed to have had other plans for him. I don't know how old I was when this terrible accident happened. I can only remember that I was only tall enough to reach up like that to turn the doorknob to open the door for my brother, who came in holding his stomach. He had been hit and crushed by 100 pounds of ice that fell on him. In those days, they had cobblestone streets. If you remember the wagons, they had big 100-pound kegs of ice bouncing around in these wagons with only a chain at the back to keep it from falling off. The wagon hit a pothole and threw a 100-pound keg of ice against the chain, broke. He fell off the stoop when he was reaching for a small piece of ice, fell on the street, the ice fell on him, and crushed him. He died 7 hours later. As I think about that, and the fact that my mother said he had a vocation, with God we believe there's no accident. Why was it I who opened the door for him? I don't know, except that my mother thought that I inherited the vocation. He was 11 years old when he died. At any rate, my childhood was like that of any other child. I got into mischievous situations with my brother, and sometimes we needed disciplining. I remember, though, that I was very bored because there was nobody to play with, and I was frustrated to no end. So I remember running away to school. Can you imagine that? And it was quite a distance. We lived across the river That meant crossing a bridge. I must have been 6 years old. And I showed up in the afternoon. I filled a pop bottle with coffee. And I had the bottle like that, and I walked into the the room. And the teacher said, "Oh, you're new here?" I don't know how my mother felt. She must have been very worried, because that was almost a three-mile walk. And across a bridge, too. At any rate, those were my school days. I devoured books. I liked reading. I liked sports, but I was denied the ability to play sports until I got to the seminary. My devotional life was like that of many other children. My mother was the one who inspired us with devotion. She had a great devotion to Our Lady. She said the rosary many times. In the end of her life, she was saying 6 rosaries a day, mainly because she could not read or write. And yet she brought up 9 children during the Depression. And she even went to work when my father was out of work. I did not know when I was going to be a priest in the first 6 years of my grade school. But I believe it was sometime in the 6th grade that I traced first signs of my vocation. I can clearly point to an ordination mass of a young priest in our town in the German parish we called St. Anthony's, celebrating his first Mass. And when he lifted up the host at consecration, the thought came to me, I would like to do that. And I remember I never changed from that thought. The pastor of our parish used to come in towards the end of the year, and he would always ask, how many want to be sisters? And half the girls put their hands up. But on graduation day, it was a different story. And the same thing with the boys. A number of them put their hands up. They wanted to be priests. And I saw this. And I said to myself, I'm not going to put my hand up until I know, and until I'm in the 8th grade. And when we were given our report cards on graduation day, he said, how many want to be priests? And I put my hand up. Now, the fact that I'm a Carmelite all seemed to be accidental. And yet, those are God's ways. I had no idea who the Carmelites were. I wanted to be a diocesan priest. And I wanted to go to a seminary in Philadelphia, wrote to them, and they said, we're filled up, can't take you. There was no other place to go, it was late. It was the last weeks of August, and seminaries open up in September. My mother knew a friend of hers whose son was a seminarian. And she said, let's go over and see them. So we went over and introduced me to her son. He was already a Carmelite, a religious. He was going to already begin his theology. So he said, I'll take you down to Holy Trinity Parish that Carmelites have and introduce you to Father George, the pastor, see if we can sign you up. In 2 weeks, I was signed up for the Carmelites. Now, that was in 1931, at the highest depths of the Depression. Now, here I had not left home for any distance beyond 50 miles. I was going to go 200 miles away. I was 13 years old. And my mother stuck by my vocation, but she did ask me, why don't you go to Millvale High School before you go? And if you know anything about high schools, you know they don't encourage vocations. And I told my mother, Mom, if I go there, I don't think I'll be fit for a priest. So she respected that. And although everybody was out of work, she took $200 out of our savings. I don't know how much more was left in the bank. There were 8 of us to be fed. So she, you might say she had a heavy investment in my vocation. So here I was, about that tall, going off to an unknown country, Canada, and testing my vocation. Well, we drove into the seminary grounds, and the first thing I saw was the barn. A great big manure pile. And that turned me off. But what happened was accumulating very slowly. All the surroundings were very strange, and we boys were free for 3 days, so we went to the American side to see a movie. And as we were watching the movie, I had this terrible feeling within me. Never had it before, I was sick. And I don't remember what the movie was. I cared less. And I was fearful. It was homesickness. It's terrible. I wouldn't wish that on anyone. But it was doubly trying because here, my mother, family had invested so much in me, and here I was homesick. I wanted to go home. It lasted 3 days, terrible 3 days. But after, and what kept me staying there was not a devout thought. It was this thought: if I go home, they'll kill me. So I stayed. But after those 3 days, it wore off, and I never changed. You couldn't have carried me out of there, even in a coffin. I loved it. And then I was introduced to all the sports world. I played everything. I played basketball, handball, baseball, football, tennis, hockey. If there was any other sport there, we played it all. It was great. I always loved sports. I still do. Fairly good at it. And I don't think at this time, at my present age, that it's an option. Now it's a necessity. But I'm thankful that I had that opportunity. And in the seminary, I was gradually, I think, brought into a deeper life with the Lord. Nothing extraordinary. We had 4 years of high school. We were all geared to the priesthood, and we had our devotions every morning. Got up at, I believe, 6:30, somewhere around that time, and we were down in the chapel, had a community mass with the entire faculty and the religious. It was a combination of a junior seminary high school, the novitiate, those introduced into religious life, then also the college, the religious who spent 3 years of college in philosophy before they went off to theology. So it was a huge institute, four floors, a large edifice built in the E shape. And then on the middle side was the chapel, beautiful Gothic style. And it's still up there. And you could see the falls from the fourth floor. And you heard the noise of the falls almost all the time. When the wind came towards you, you could hear the roar. So those years in high school were a gradual growth, nothing extraordinary. I still went in for a lot of sports. I used to even go in for muscle building. They had these rubber stretchers, you know. Well, I used to get up, my classmates tell me, remember the time you got in the dormitory in the alcove and used to stretch the Jiffy Gym? I got up early in the other so I wouldn't disturb them. But I was, you know, macho-minded. And we had different responsibilities in the seminary. I had charge of the bookshop. Students who were there in high school had to pay their own way. They paid for books and whatever they used, so I was in charge of that. Later on, I was one of the co-editors of the school paper, which meant that I had to learn typing early. I thank God for that, because I do a lot of typing to these days. And we were gradually introduced also into public speaking. Even in our high school years, Friday afternoon was a time for public speaking. the entire faculty, the body, the high school students and the teachers assembled in the assembly room. And a number were selected a month before to prepare a speech, but then about a half hour towards the end, the director of the seminarians just by chance selected three or four to get up and just talk off the cuff, as we say, to develop the ability to speak extemporaneously. So we had a lot of experience in public speaking. And later on, after the novitiate, we were already professed Carmelites. We had to prepare little sermons that were given to the entire religious community. And this was our first experience in giving sermons. But we also had an elocution contest. In other words, whoever gave the best speech won a prize. Well, over the years, I was a runner-up. There were two of us who were finalists. And I still think I should have won because I was more dramatic. But I was disqualified for one thing. I tried to imitate Bishop Sheen in a closing. No, it was my own voice, my own speech, but he had a dramatic way of ending. And the judge said, in a true elocution speech, you should taper off. And I lost on that point. At any rate, those were some of my experiences in elocution. But all through our seminary days, we were given opportunities to speak, and I think that was very good. I thank God that I had that kind of experience. But as I moved into the novitiate, this was the what you call the one-year period when you're introduced into Carmelite life. Up until that time, you were just given a little introduction into it, gradually introduced into religious life. And once we received the habit, then we were brought into the full stream of community life. My experience, that was truly a conversion experience, began at that time. That was 1935. I don't know the exact date, except that it was in the fall, probably October, an Indian summer day. We as novices had to see to the upkeep of the ground, beautiful grounds. After we'd been out working that afternoon, we came in, we had about an hour to shower and just kind of relax and get orientated for the divine office and then the half hour of mental prayer before supper time. At that time, I was reading the life of St. Teresa Little Flower. I don't know what chapter I was reading, but it was while I was reading that this event happened. I suddenly became aware of someone who loved me. Not this general platitude, God loves everyone, but I knew someone loved me. I felt it. Or it wasn't platonic, I felt it. And that wasn't outside of me, it was inside. And of course, who could that be? The Lord. It just kept coming on in waves. And I didn't know how to react to it. I was completely taken by surprise. So you can't say that I earned it or I did anything to deserve it. I try to respond to it. And anything I said or anything I thought wasn't adequate to what I felt. So I fell on my knees and I stretched out my hands and that seemed like it was so useless. And then the thought hit me, if this is the Lord and this is what heaven is like, I want to die. I was 19 at the time. So I tried to die. Now, how could you die? Well, I thought that I could burst an artery. If I took real deep breaths, I'd just burst my heart, and that would be it. So I was heaving, taking real deep breaths. And what do you know? Here I am. It didn't happen. Well, that wasn't the end of it. That was just the beginning. I don't know how many days or weeks that I was in a different world. I think psychologically you could say I was psychologically disorientated. In other words, in a confused state as to anything outside of me. Oh, I was sure what was inside, and that's all I wanted. But I could care less about anything else. Now, that could be dangerous, as I learned, but God's love was so palpable, touched, that I could think of nothing else. Don't let anybody tell you that you cannot pray all day long. It was hard for me not to pray. Prayer is awareness. That essentially is prayer. I had that all the time. All the time. Even my classmates, I heard them say behind my back as I walked down the corridor, "He's lost." I would clutch, I had a little cross that I carried around my neck. I still have it today. I put it on my pillow each day as I make my bed. But I've had that cross now for 50 years. That's the cross that I clutched to remind me of the Lord's presence. I had to acknowledge that presence. I couldn't go around like this, but I would, under the habit, have that cross in my hands. And I could hardly wait at times to get to my room and let go. Just be with the Lord. Just love Him and be loved. Now, that's the next thing to heaven on earth, let me tell you. I found it easy to pray, and yet in the community they all use books. I didn't need a book. So I didn't want to be an oddball, so I'd keep the book open to me, but I didn't need it. And I felt obligated to pray even longer because I felt very blessed. So I decided to give the Lord another hour of prayer besides the hour that the community gained. But I couldn't do that without being too noticed. So I would close the closet door of my room, and I would pray in there for an hour. Now, that wasn't easy in the summertime with a full habit. But the one thing I hated most was if somebody would knock on the door and say, "Bernard, let's go out and play ball." And then look in and then open the closet door and look in and say, "What are you doing in there?" But that was a pressing obligation. I felt that I could not deny that to the Lord. I could read Scripture. I could comment on anything, pray on anything in Scripture. I had a moral strength that I could have done anything. Even if they had put me up against the wall in a firing squad and they would say, "Deny the Lord," I would say, "Praise be Jesus Christ, shoot!" I don't know that I could say that now. But virtue came easy. And that could be a dangerous thing too, because it could make a person overzealous, judgmental. And I was guilty of that, because I felt others didn't match up to the way I felt. I became critical, and I had to be corrected for that. The Lord reminded me in different ways. I also did not want to go to recreation. That was wrong. That was a community exercise. It was God's will. For me to want to be in my room would be to do my own thing, and I had to recognize that. But I found recreation very trying. I could not follow conversation. I once was very embarrassed because I was trying to be part of the conversation, and I couldn't follow the sequence of the conversation. And yet I tried to be part of it, so I would say once in a while, "How?" Now, after the fifth time, one of the other classmates looked at me and he said, "What are you, an Indian?" And I was so embarrassed, I could have crawled in a hole and zipped it over. Just couldn't follow the conversation. And that's the way it was for months. How long, I don't know at this point. But for me then, that one day was an atomic bomb, a spiritual atomic bomb, and I've never been the same since. Now, if they had a contemplative house at that time, I would have gone there. But I had to wait 17 years before I had that opportunity to go to the Alps in Austria. At any rate, my years after the novitiate were studies in philosophy, and they were glorious times. But after 3 years, you should know that we first take simple vows. It's a testing time to try it for 3 years. After the third year, you take solemn vows. So that was in 1939. I was professed in 1936. My solemn vows were in 1939. Prior to that day, I had a crisis of conscience. I do think it was a spirit of evil. I kept a diary of what the Lord was doing for me, but I also saw things that I was doing. It was partly, I think, the Lord's enlightenment, but partly the spirit of evil trying to discourage me from continuing as a Carmelite. I was so shaken by these thoughts that I took my diary, tore it up, and threw it in the furnace. And that didn't seem to solve the problem. Then I finally went to the superior of the house, and I told him what I was doing and my faults. And he understood that it was a crisis of vocation, that it was a temptation. And he cleared it up for me, although I did have to acknowledge that I was being judgmental. And after that, I got peace of mind. The day before the solemn profession, always a very solemn day, the superior of our professed, there was a superior of the house, another superior of the students. This superior seemed to sense that some of us were uptight, including me. And what he did was, before we went to bed that night, well, I better put it this way. When I walked into my room after night prayers, I turned on the light, and what did I see? A tall glass of wine and a note. It said, "Drink this." And I was suspicious. I said, "Somebody's playing a joke on me. I'm going to fool him. I'm going to scrub my teeth, put on my pajamas, I'm going to sit on my bed, and down the hatch." And that's just what I did. I fell into bed. It was the best night of sleep I ever had. And later on I found it was the superior. Now look how understanding he was. And so we were professed and my family was there. It was a very blessed time. Some of the pictures you'll see today are in that album. And then we moved on to Washington, D.C. for our philosophy. But I sensed that there was a change in my spiritual life with the Lord. It wasn't one thing, it was a number of things. When God purifies us, he doesn't have to pull out different things in our life that are totally strange to where we are. It's just the circumstances in which we live. So my purification was part of the community, my own inner life with the Lord, and just the fact that I was moving on closer to ordination and the heavy obligation that that brought. And dryness in prayer, a number of things that were in conflict. I was far from what I needed to be. My emotional life was very tense. In fact, they had a nickname for me. Some of them called me board back. I would walk real straight. That's a sign of tension, too. Well, at any rate, it reached a crisis. So much so that after it was over, the superior of the house said to me, "I didn't think you'd make it." And that's how evident it was to everybody around me. There were times when I thought I could not keep my sanity. I was so troubled. And what brought about an eventual relief was something very simple. A lower classman thought of writing a play. We always had plays in the seminary. at different times, for Christmas, for Easter, on a special occasion. So they thought of this skit, as we call it. It was going to be a, what do they call that? They ham it up, you know, it's ham comedy. And they asked me if I'd take the part. It was the star part. At that time, I was a deacon. And when they told me what it was, I said, no way, forget it. But I thought about it, and I went to my superior and I said, do you think I should take this part? And he said, why not? Because nobody from outside is going to be here. The only ones from outside are our sisters here who do our cooking. They know the community. So on his recommendation, I decided to try the part. So I know you're going to laugh. It's awful. Well, as we got into the part, I began to sense a release of my tension. Among some of the things that I was going through was I was not accepted by many in the community. And there was a distance, and it was hard to bear. And as we got into the part, I felt a relief, a relaxation, because it was totally different from what I am. It was a complete switch, so much so that the community was surprised when they saw me come out on stage. Oh, they knew I was the singer. Well, the part was that I was to appear as a Spanish prima donna señorita. If you knew me in those days, you'd say, no way. Well, to be authentic, they went to Catholic University to get a ballerina outfit. Red, no less. A red skirt, a beautiful silk mantilla over my head, comb, all the proper makeup. But to ham it up, my arms were bare, and then I had sweat socks and bedroom slippers on. So I came out flat-footed. But nobody knew how I was going to appear. The scene was, these two Romeos were going to serenade me. So here I was backstage, singing some scales. Everybody out in the community said, oh, that's Bernard. And then, in the excitement, these two Romeos, instead of putting the ladder up this way, they put it up this way and try to climb. Well, that was a source of laughter. So it came time for me to come out. Well, I knew what was going to happen, so I took off my glasses. All I wanted to see out there was a blur. And so I came padding out, and there was a gasp. And then there was bedlam for about 3 minutes. They couldn't believe that this was Bernard. So we handed up. I sang the Toreador song, and during the course of that, they had constructed a bull. In fact, the head was very authentic and big enough for someone to put his head in there and a big rubber inner tube tongue pulling it in and out. And they had barrel staves in the middle with blankets over, you know, and then the feet were made into, what would they call them, cloven feet? So there were two in this particular animal. And as it was coming down the back, down the aisle, the sister was unprepared for this. She saw this apparition, she said, oh! And she reached down, she pulled part of the blanket on. Here, one of them was looking out. Well, anyhow, they went up on stage. As you know, those things do. One wants to move and the other sits down. And one sits down, the other one stands up. So they did those shenanigans. And that was part of the slapstick, we call it. Slapstick. So here was I singing these baritone songs, Old Man River, bare arms, you know, hairy legs. Prima donna with with a baritone voice. But at any rate, our prior general from Rome was there that day. Of all the times he had to be there. And he came up after and said, you know, he said, I didn't think you could do that. Now, at any rate, I sensed there was an easing of in my emotional life after that. How wouldn't there be in anyone? But look how the Lord works. See, nothing is by accident. And yet he used a very human situation to kind of ease me into a healing. See, that was an emotional healing. And I was so conscience-stricken about having to handle the consciences of, you know, thousands of people and the burden of that, that I read a five-volume set of casuists of all kinds of moral cases. It must have been about 2,000 pages. And, you know, after all these years, I think I've only handled about three cases like that. Well, anyway, the ordination date came by, and that was May 28th. It was a very humid day. If you've ever been in Washington, you know it's terrible, below sea level. There were 63 or 65 to be ordained from different seminaries, among them Dominicans, Franciscans, Benedictines, Capuchins, Carmelites, and a number of other communities. All I can remember at that solemn moment, if you know what the ordination ceremony is like, the most solemn moment is, it's a quiet, silent time, when the bishop says nothing, just imposes his hands on the person to be ordained. Then he moves on to the next, and all the priests present do the same. What that is, it's a communication of the Holy Spirit without words. That is the ordination. Well, at that moment, all I can see was fire. That's all I remember. I did ask the Lord, and we were told that on the ordination day, a priest received all the graces he would need for a lifetime. So I asked for the works. I said, Lord, I need so much, you better pour it on. And that's all I remember, fire. And, of course, the first ones to come for the blessing afterward were my mother and father and my sister, my brother John. It was a very, it's hard to put into words. A cousin of mine, when I visited them in South Yugoslavia, said very, in a very earnest, serious way, how did you feel when you held the Lord in your hands? And as I thought back on that from my first Mass, it was awesome. My senses deceived me, as yours too. All you see is bread, tastes like bread, but it isn't. But the fact that I could do that, in other words, that I can make God present, that was awesome. And I think, regarding the Mass, the one person who is most challenged to renew his faith is the priest, because he could become so casual and so forgetful that even sometimes he might even forget that he said the words of consecration. That's how much of a habit it could become. And yet we should never, never be casual about this supreme act of worship. It is so glorious that our mind just couldn't conceive the blessings and the glory of it for heaven and earth. It is the greatest act of worship, infinite in its value. Well, I went home for a preparation for my first solemn Mass, and that's when some of the pictures were taken, and you'll see me. I'm wide-eyed, open like a little Bambi, with the oils fresh on my hands, and some people would think I was 15 years old, but I was 24. The first Mass was on Corpus Christi, and I remember it very well, because the pastor had me take the Blessed Sacrament in a large coupe. You know what that is? For the blessed, when you have the benediction? Well, here I was marching around the church three times on a hot June 6th day. Church was packed, and I was just soaked inside. But it was nothing compared to that moment. And all the people that I've known since boyhood, my own classmates, the entire parish was there. Many friends from different parts of the country were there. And my own superior provincial, he was an Irishman, was there. And he gave a talk. He was very fluent in language. He knew like 7 or 8 languages fluently, and among them, Croatian. So at the reception dinner, he stood up, and in Croatian he said, "I am not Croatian. I am not Slovenian. I am Irish." And he said that in Croatian. And everybody said, "Oh!" Everybody was surprised. Understandably, my parents were very happy. My mother especially. Let me tell you, too, that it is true that behind many a priest, there is a woman. In my case, it was my mother. Well, my first assignment was to assist the novice master in the table dance of the Allegheny Mountains in Pennsylvania. I spent the better part of 2.5 years there. It was a very blessed time because I was still going through a time of purification. And it was also a time to move into deeper prayer. Again, look how the Lord arranges things. But it was that time that I also became a beekeeper. I had 7 beehives, and you'll see a picture in the album. And each beehive had about 70,000 bees. Believe me, I had a few stings to my credit. But the first season, we took off 21 gallons of honey. So those little bees are very wonderful workers. And they don't complain when you take away their honey, except their, what we call their own food, a brood chamber. You always preserve that. Later on, after that, I was assigned as a teacher in Mount Carmel High School in Chicago, one of the largest boys' high school in Chicago. And I taught there for 7 years. At that time, I moved into a more active life, very active, as a matter of fact. And I taught religion, Spanish, and world history. I also went to the university to get a bachelor's degree in Spanish and also a minor in history in order to continue to teach and be qualified. But at that time, too, I asked for an opportunity to develop my voice and move into the field of music. So my superior allowed me to go to Chicago Conservatory. I accelerated my studies and by taking tutoring. So I covered 2 years of harmony in 1 year, and to save money, also save time. And after 3 years, I also moved into getting a master's degree in modern composition, which was completed in 1951. My master's thesis was on the Te Deum, composed for a choir of 40 voices and 4 solo voices with an orchestra. I'd like to hear it played sometime. But to this day, I haven't found that opportunity. It was at this time that I tried to have a second career, which was not met with approval by my community. I did have a group that I worked with introducing people to sacred music and the history of sacred music. We made 9 sessions that were played over FM Chicago radio for a period of 7 to 9 weeks. And I had gathered a number of professional singers. In fact, one of them won the auditions for the Chicago Opera, a baritone. The other was a basso who sang professionally throughout Chicago. The other was a tenor who eventually ended up with Fred Waring's choir. So I had good singers. And we performed several times, but that was about the end of it. Didn't move into anything. I did want to do recordings. I did want to make auditions. And here's where God indicated that he did not want this. I had the best studio in Chicago, Studio A at NBC. I had the best accompanist, and we had unlimited time. I prepared some songs, we sang them, and when I heard the...